This is Night Call, the new nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight's subject, What Are We Doing in Vietnam? Part 1. Tonight's guest, State Department Officer Steve Letigar of the Vietnam Working Group on The Official Position. You speak for yourself and ask your questions directly by calling Collect Night Call's national phone number, area code 212-749-3311, or in the New York area, 866-5010. Night Call's host in New York City is Del Shields.
Good evening. We begin tonight an entire week's programming devoted to the question, what are we doing in Vietnam? It is not our purpose to trace the history of our involvement there, but rather to find out our purpose and policy now, and to present as many different responsible views of it, critical and otherwise, as we can in the course of 5 programs. Tonight's guest, whose purpose is to explain the official position, is State Department Officer Stephen Letigar of the Bureau of Far Eastern Affairs. He'll be followed on succeeding nights by 2 outspoken critics of our policy and our actions in Vietnam. One, a staunch defender of the administration and our military, and a professional journalist who has worked both as a newsman and a State Department official in Vietnam, who will attempt to give us a balanced view. That last is Fortune editor John Mecklen. A paraphrase of something in his recent book, Mission in Torment, says very nicely exactly how we'd like our guest to approach this week's guests on this very, very emotional subject. Please keep in mind that we are all Americans in an uncommonly difficult spot, and that the errors and successes we will be talking about are American errors and successes. We welcome your calls with your questions, comments, and conversation at our national phone number, area code 212-749-3311. And you may call Collect, that's national calls, on area code 212-749-3311. In the New York area, you may call us at 866-5010. That's 866-5010 for local calls. Again, our guest tonight, State Department Officer Stephen Letigar of the Bureau of Far Eastern Affairs. Mr. Letigar served in our Saigon embassy from mid-1964 to early 1967 and has since been a member of the State Department's Vietnam Working Group, which helps determine our policy in that country. Mr. Letigar, good evening. Thank you so much for being with us. Could you begin by briefly summing up exactly what our official position in Vietnam is? That is, what is our officially stated purpose for being there, and what are we doing to successfully carry out that purpose?
Well, that's a very tall order in the short time we have. Let's take it in terms of an objective, that is to say the end, and not discussing the policies or the means to the end. The objective, I think, has been very clearly stated many times, and it would be like this, that given the facts of today, we are committed to South Vietnamese people and to our allies in the free world, and we find that it is in our own national interest to assist the South Vietnamese people in maintaining the option for a political solution for their country, other than the one that Hanoi is presently attempting to impose upon them by force. And we hope at the same time to establish conditions for a more durable peace in Vietnam and elsewhere in Southeast Asia, to avoid a wider war, and to bring the conflict to an end as soon as possible with as little violence as possible.
Aware that this is our official policy and our reasons for being in Vietnam, could you, as a officer, tell us what has been the reason for so much emotionalism concerning our stay in Vietnam?
Well, I'm not too sure I can tell you. I don't know the answer to that. I know that it has been very unfortunate. I know that it has served very few people. I know that it has reduced in magnitude and shrillness very much in the last few months, especially since President Johnson's March 31st speech. I, for one, am glad to see that there's possibility again of dialogue between the government, its spokesmen, and various people in this country, and that we've gotten away from name-calling, from passion and prejudice on this subject, which is so vitally important to all of us.
Could you explain the change in the American policy which brought U.S. combat forces into Vietnam for the first time in March of 65?
Well, there really had been a long series of decisions. The possibility that U.S. combat forces might be necessary had been obviously considered by previous administrations and had been considered by this administration at times previous to the one that you mentioned. It was decided at that time that the only choice that we had in light of the deteriorating military situation and the not too favorable political situation in the short run, that this was an unhappy alternative that had to be faced. Either that or fall short of our objectives, as I tried to state it before.
In the New York Times, the book review section yesterday, I don't know if you had a chance to read it, but in the review of a new book called A Secret Search for Peace in Vietnam, did you by chance have a chance to review this?
I've read a couple of reviews of that book, but I have not read the book itself.
Well, David Schoenbaum, who reviewed the book for The Times, and I'd like to just read two paragraphs. He says, how is it possible for our leaders, honorable men, intelligent men, experienced men, with all the information they need to get us into such a terrible mess as this wretched war in Vietnam? And the authors Kraslow and Lurie give a depressing answer. It is not only possible, it is almost inevitable, given the present complexities and secrecy shrouding war and peace decisions. The moral to be drawn should be obvious to all citizens. Less secrecy and more public dialogue must accompany decisions of war and peace, both inside and outside the corridors of State, Defense, and White House. Without becoming involved in terms of what some of the issues are that might be classified material, could you possibly give us an idea as to what your reaction is to this statement?
Well, first of all, I find it rather amusing, and I wonder if the Times made the choice with a straight face to choose Mr. Schoenbrunn to review that book. He is, if anything, far more critical of anything that this administration and previous ones have done in Vietnam than I guess from what the review indicates is even the author. I would rather not comment on the book itself since I haven't read it. All I can say is I gather from the substance of these reviews that the authors feel as though it is the United States that has been the victim, that has been the villain, rather, in failure to achieve agreements for preliminary talks or negotiations at a time prior to when they did start 2 months ago. Now, I find it very difficult to hold that position, to make a persuasive argument for it, in the light of the overt, well-known, on-the-record attempts by this country during the past 4 years to get the negotiations started. During the fifth meeting in Paris, let me see if I have the paper here now. During the fifth meeting in Paris, Governor Harriman handed to the North Vietnamese delegate two papers, very scholarly documents, to refute points that he had tried to bring up in some of the previous sessions. One of them was a rather persuasive document pointing to the massive evidence about the existence of North Vietnamese troops in the South. The other one was a document that listed some 15 or 20 attempts at bringing the two sides together that had occurred prior to 1967, April 67. And these were all done by third parties, such as Pope Paul, British Foreign Secretary, Prime Minister of the British Commonwealth, the Indian government, 17 non-allied nations, and so forth. All of these attempts that were made, and what was our position, our response to each attempt, and what was Hanoi's response. So I think the book that you quote there is carrying a terribly heavy burden to argue the opposite of what Governor Harriman put on the record there. And it's not a question of secrets, it's not a question of covert diplomacy at all.
With all of the rhetoric and the debate about Vietnam, does it actually come down, or is it possible that it comes down to one or two questions? First, is it a constitutional question that has or has not been settled? And two, does it concern the power of the president to authorize this kind of war, this kind of confrontation with an enemy?
I'm not too sure I understand the distinction between those points. You said, is it a constitutional question?
Right, at this point, after all of this is being said, does it still go back to raising a question constitutionally about the authority for this war?
Well, I don't believe that there are very many critics of our present objective and of our present policies pursuit of that objective who have come around to a point of trying to justify their criticism on the basis that the president does not have or did not have the legal authority, the constitutional authority, to take the steps which he has taken in the past three presidents, that is.
We'll begin.
I know that there are some there have been some discussions, and some of them have been take place in Congress about the origins and background of the so-called Gulf of Tonkin resolution. But the administration has stated many times, and I think has been upheld by most constitutional scholars, that the Gulf of Tonkin resolution was sought by the administration in its role as a leader, not as authority. By no means as legal authority to pursue a course that it had already decided was necessary.
It sought the permission from Congress as a leader, is that what you said?
It sought to receive an expression of the representatives of the people in support of a program that it had decided was necessary. That expression of support and approval, it should not be mistaken with legal authority. The president has all the authority he needs under the Constitution to take the steps which he did. And I'm talking not only about President Johnson, but President Kennedy also.
We'll begin taking some calls from our nightclub listeners, night call listeners, rather, here in New York. And we'll accept our first call from Washington, D.C. Mr. Lettergar, Mr. Constantine is listening to Night Call over WAMU-FM in Washington. Welcome to Night Call, sir.
Good evening. I have a question to ask you. There's been a lot of talk about settling the war in Vietnam for the past 20 years. And I happen to be reminiscing about, there was an article that was in one of the newspaper magazines a year ago about Cuba being taken over by the communists in 1959. What puzzles me is, I haven't still been able to understand it too clearly, but I noticed that they send our forces over to Vietnam, thousands of miles away, and right here in our own backyard, the communists take over Cuba, and it seems like they were doing it. It seems like Cuba was more deeply destroyed than Vietnam in less time. And I can't understand why we didn't have troops or more of them in Cuba to save it from the communists.
Well, this is a difficult question. It's a very good one, but I think we have to take it in the context of what it is that threatens our own national interest. There are lots of countries who have governments that we don't particularly approve of all around the world. They're totalitarians of the left, Marxist-Leninist totalitarians. They're totalitarians of the right that we don't approve of. The thing that really threatens our national interest is when one or a group of nations enter into a program of expansionism. Aggression is the word we use. When when it is entirely internal within one country, we do not have the resources, and indeed we don't feel that in the absence of specific agreements of one sort or another, we don't feel we have the right to go in and say we do not approve of the turn that the government of this country is about to take. That's different, though, when one country starts to expand into another. Now, the situation in Vietnam is very clearly one of aggression by North Vietnam against South Vietnam, two separate political entities that were established in 1954. The situation in Cuba, when it became threatening, was dealt with, I think, rather appropriately at that time.
I see. But it seems, anyways, it's a little bit hard to hear you over the line, but I think I understand what you're trying to get across. But it still seems in my mind, really, that I guess subconsciously, that something like this would happen in our own backyard. But I understand that you, since you're representative of the State Department, I guess, are there still boats? I mean, I understand we still have Navy vessels.
Mr. Constantine, I must stop you, sir, because we must break for station identification. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.
Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Stephen Ledigar after station identification. Listen to the voices of Night Call.
Prophet Isaiah says, your cities are burning because there is injustice in your land, and the Lord will not hear you because your hands are full of blood. Now, I will interpret that to say, the United States is on fire, its cities are burning because there's injustice in the land, and the Lord above will not hear the cries of people like Lyndon Baines Johnson because his hands are full of blood.
Stokely Carmichael quotes the Bible in support of militancy. And a National Guard commander says ballots, not bullets, are the best ammunition.
I think you have a tremendous power in the democracy of the ballot box. It's much stronger than bullets. You do have the ballot box, which is far stronger than any sort of suppression.
Night Call, the new nationwide call-in show on vital issues, each weeknight on this station. Speak for yourself, collect on Night Call, area code 212-749-3311 or 866-5010 to Stephen Ledigar about what are we doing in Vietnam. Again, Del Shields.
And we'll accept our next call from Mr. Bodie, who is listening to Night Call over WFLA in St. Petersburg, Florida. Welcome to Night Call, sir.
Thank you, sir. Good evening. I would like to ask your guest, sir, does he have any estimate of the percentage of the South Vietnamese population that might be in sympathy with the National Liberation Front?
Well, I'll be glad to give you what is best estimate of that. There's no way of measuring it accurately.
Yes, sir.
But it brings up an important point, if I may take time to make it.
Yes, sir.
I'll try to be brief. And that is that the U.S. foreign policy in Vietnam stands or falls on the following. We believe that the majority, the vast bulk of the South Vietnamese people, given any sort of an opportunity to express their preference, free of force or of coercion, would opt for some solution other than the program of the National Liberation Front, other than Hanoi's solution. We don't say they'd agree on the present government or the present form of government. We just know that the mass of them would agree that they don't want what the North Vietnamese are trying to cram down their throats by force. Now, the best estimate we could give would be something in the nature of 15 to 18%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can't recall exactly what the basis of those estimates are. It happens to be the same percentage of the South Vietnamese people that presently is under Viet Cong control.
Yes, sir. The next question I have, sir, is that in the recent elections that were held in South Vietnam, was the National Liberation Front represented at all?
Absolutely not.
And was there a reason for this, sir?
Yes, the year before these elections, you'll recall, throughout the country, the people went to the polls and voted for representatives from each province to the Constituent Assembly.
Mm-hmm.
These representatives came together, drafted the Constitution, and drafted the election laws.
Mm-hmm.
In their wisdom, they decided that there were various things that disqualified people for running. Like in this country, for example, they said no one who is a felon may run. They also said that no one who does not have pure Vietnamese citizenship may run. They went on to say that no one who is opposed to the very principles of this Constitution may run. And they specifically named communists as being opposed to the principles of the Constitution. And this is the controversial part. They also said that those neutralists who advocate a communist solution also may not run. Now, this disqualified not only all of the National Liberation Front representatives, but some who would fall significantly short of communism, but say for in favor of recognition of the NLF.
Yes, sir. One last thing, sir, is that it would seem then that that the war might be prolonged by not recognizing part of the population there that have wishes for communism. Not that we would want this at all, and I'm sure that's the reason so much has been paid by America in lives and money and resources to try to preserve these people's freedom. But it would seem to me that if the negotiators were allowed to at least admit that elections would be held, although I know that you have said the Constitution prohibits this, if there could be something worked out there, it seems to me that it's doubtful if we'll ever have peace unless we recognize this segment of the population. I'd like your comment on that.
I think that we a couple of distinctions we should make here, Mr. Bodie. First of all, we're not presently negotiating. These are by statement of both sides, initial contacts between two of the parties to the conflict.
Yes, sir.
And it's not negotiations by any means yet. Second of all, is that we have gone on record many times as favoring a solution to the entire Vietnamese struggle on the basis of self-determination of the people, not only in the South, but of all the Vietnamese people with a view towards eventual reunification. Now, obviously, if there's going to be true self-determination in the South, there's going to have to be some arrangement whereby all South Vietnamese, and that would include the National Liberation Front, may freely politic, may freely do peaceful things to push their programs and then put the issue to the entire population.
Yes, sir.
We're confident on the basis of the figures, for example, that I gave you in the first part of your question, that as to what the results would be, but we are committed to abide by them. Now, this, a lot of people confuse the fact that because the elections last September excluded members of the National Liberation Front, the same program would be insisted upon, the same election laws would be insisted upon for some plebiscite that would possibly be the basis, a negotiated basis for settlement of the conflict. That's not so. That's a misunderstanding to confuse those two.
Mr. Bodie?
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much for calling, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. This is Night Call in New York. What are we doing in Vietnam? And our guest tonight calling in from Washington, D.C. is State Department Officer William Lettergard. We'll take our next call from Nashville, Tennessee. Mr. Gregory is listening to Night Call over WVOL. Welcome to Night Call, sir.
I would like to ask, who first invited American military intervention into Vietnam?
Who first invited it?
Hello?
Yes, I'm not sure. Was your question who first invited our aid?
Military force in Vietnam, yes.
Well, it was the French.
But did the Vietnamese people, what was the sentiment of the land at that time?
Well, essential to our objective and all the policies in pursuit of that objective is a continuing everyday invitation by the Vietnamese people and their legitimate government to come help them and stay there. A lot of people don't realize that should it come to pass that tomorrow the South Vietnamese government decides, or the people should decide and just say we've had enough, we'd rather be red than dead, we have to leave. So it's a continuing invitation. Now, how far back does it go? We've supported every one of 10 governments back through and including the long period of Ngo Dinh Diem. We supported Bao Dai. We supported the French, who were the major contributors of military aid in the early days of the independence of the state of Vietnam. We also supported the French independently by themselves. We also were involved in the area, of course, in the years immediately following World War II. We were involved in support of Ho Chi Minh, oddly enough, as you probably read, during World War II, because he was a guerrilla fighting the Japanese, and it goes back not much before that period.
Does that answer your question, sir?
Sure.
Yes.
Did you have another question?
Yes. We had a civil war here in America. Why not let them have their civil war there in Vietnam? I still don't see the reason for intervention there. I understand what you just said, but it still doesn't warrant our intervention and giving away our boy's life there in another country to...
Mr. Gregory, our discussion tonight is not the Civil War here in America. We're going to take care of that on some other nights. Tonight, we're asking...
I would like to answer that, if I may.
All right, be my guest.
Mr. Gregory, if this were a civil war in Vietnam, we would be absolutely and tragically wrong. The fact is that communist propaganda notwithstanding, and the fact that a whole lot of people here are mistakenly confused by the issue, as well one may be, into thinking that it is a civil war, the fact is that it is not a civil war. They're two separate political entities, albeit they are two both Vietnamese, just as East-West Germany are both Germany and North-South Korea are both Korean. Two separate political entities, and the one has, contrary to international law, contrary to Chapter 1 of the United Nations Charter, contrary to everything that we fought through World War II and otherwise for, has decided to impose its solution on the other half by force. And it is in an attempt to maintain for the victims of that aggression the opportunity to work out their future free of force that were involved in that. If it was, it happens to be complicated by the fact that there are some non-communist nationalists on the side of the Viet Cong in the South. There are some, but their existence does not change the essential overall characterization. As a matter of fact, unfortunately, they are so monolithic in their control, in their security, that we cannot separate them from those who are just Paul Parrots of the Hanoi Line. But I repeat the first thing. If it were a civil war, we're wrong. It absolutely is not a civil war. And therefore, there should be no analogy made to a civil war in this country or in any other country in the world.
Okay, to answer my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gregory. Thank you for calling. This is Night Call in New York. What are we doing in Vietnam? Our guest calling from Washington State Department Officer William Lettergard. And we'll take our next call from Cleveland, Ohio. Mr. Larson is listening to Night Call over WERE. Welcome to Night Call, sir.
Hello.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, well, since Mr. Lettergard knows that we were fighting on the side of Ho Chi Minh, among other things, he apparently is very well informed on the history of Vietnam. So, it makes it all the more curious, some of his arguments, because as far as emotion goes on this issue, it seems to me one of the reasons there's so much emotion is that this entire case for the administration is, as far as I'm concerned, a fabrication, so that anyone who tries to advocate the case is automatically insulting the intelligence of any opposition. I would take issue with everything that Mr. Lettergard has said, and as I say, I can't help but believe that he's aware of the ambiguity of some of the things he is saying. I mean, as far as he has mentioned Hanoi on several occasions, in a very emphatic way as to its contribution in this situation, and even the best authorities are very cautious on this issue. I mean, Senator Mansfield in 1965 went to South Vietnam, and he reported something like 400 people from the North. And this was after we had after we had something like 150,000 of our own troops there, and after we had begun bombarding the North. So there's no question at all that it's the question of aggression from the North is simply not true. It's just not true at all. And this is borne out by all the authorities on this question. It's an absurdity. And so are the negotiations. The negotiations are an absurdity too. And the best example.
Mr. Larson?
While we are negotiating, we're bombing the country.
Mr. Larson, we're going to ask you to hold your call, and if you'd like to stay on the line, you may. We're going to break for station identification, and then we'll be coming right back. I know Mr. Lettergaard would like to answer you.
I'm not sure. Yes, thank you.
Yes, thank you. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Stephen Lettergaard after station identification. In our city and state, and all across the United States, people are talking about trouble, black and white trouble. Some call it racial tension, or see poverty as the real problem, or say law and order has given way to anarchy in our streets. Most people agree, at least, that there is a crisis, and we are a people with many unanswered questions. This station believes you deserve to ask your own questions and get some answers, or at least opinions, from people who should know what they're talking about. So we bring you Night Call, the new nationwide listener call-in show where you ask your questions and express your opinions to leaders such as John Lindsay, Ralph Abernathy, John Gardner, Stokely Carmichael, and Sergeant Shriver. Night Call, the new nationwide radio forum on important issues facing you and the rest of the nation. Night Call, each weeknight. Speak for yourself, collect on Night Call, area code 212-749-3311 or 866-5010 to Stephen Lettergaard about what are we doing in Vietnam. Again, Del Shields.
And welcome to the Night Call stations who join us for the second half hour just prior to station identification. Mr. Larson, who's calling in from Cleveland, Ohio, listening to Night Call over WERE, was beginning to address, or was in the process, I should say, of addressing his question to Mr. Lettergaard. Mr. Larson?
Yes.
Right. You may continue, sir.
Thank you. Yes, as for the sympathy for the NLF, Donald Duncan, the Special Forces Sergeant, has said that a guerrilla movement requires the overwhelming support of the population, and I dare say this is axiomatic. And, of course, they've been there so many years, so I don't think there's any question that they must have the overwhelming support of the population. And, of course, I hate to repeat again General Eisenhower, who said that he thought that 80% of the people would vote communist. And there's also General Ford, who said, I think we should go back to the 1954 Geneva agreements and hold free elections in Vietnam. I have no doubt that they would go communist. But our own political morality demands that we abide by the results of free elections. This is General Ford. And, I just want to conclude my statement by saying that actually this issue is no longer academic, and it's quite impossible not to be emotional, because take William F. Pepper, who says that we have burned and killed a million children in Vietnam, and Senator Edward Kennedy, who says that we are killing 150,000 civilians every year, and this is substantiated further by David Schoenbrunn, who says that we have killed a million civilians. And I referred to the New York Times yesterday, an article by Bernard Weinroth, who says something like 3 million civilians are refugees and displaced. And so this is genocide. And there's simply no possibility for any academic justification for this any further.
Mr. Lettergaard?
Yeah, well, I'm not too sure that was really a question, and I think that Mr. Larson has in his mind disqualified me completely. He began by saying that I was ill-informed, ill-mannered, or obviously a charlatan who knows better and is trying to pull the wool over someone's eyes. So I'm not too sure that talking to Mr. Larson is really going to help. It's a little bit terrifying to me that he throws out misquotes such as, and I would just pick out a few of them. To anyone in the audience who is dispassionate and who would like to be a scholar, please read General Eisenhower's book, page 372, Mandate in Charge. That's that so-called 80% figure. See whether he was talking about during the time of the war between the French and the Viet Minh, and see whether he was talking about a contest between Ho Chi Minh and Bao Dai, or did it have anything to do with what so many critics talk about, the situation that they think might have been the results in 56 had there been elections, or the situation that might obtain in South Vietnam alone today after 14 entirely misquoted Senator Kennedy, so I don't even care to talk about that. The 1 million children napalmed figure is so absurd that it hardly even justifies airtime. There have been eminent physicians, there have been your representatives who have gone over there who have documented as close as possible the tragically high number of civilian casualties caused by both sides in this war. The figures are nowhere near those that you put out. And I think that you really should do a little bit more of research and reading and accurate quoting before you spread that junk around.
This is Night Call in New York, area code 212-749-3311. Remember, you may call collect. We welcome your comments and your conversations. Our national telephone number, area code 212-749-3311. What are we doing in Vietnam? Our guest tonight calling in from Washington, State Department Officer William Lettergar. Our next call comes in from New York. Mr. Lewis is listening to Night Call over WLIB-FM. Welcome to Night Call, sir. Mr. Lewis? Well, Mr. Lewis is gone, I believe. All right, while we are preparing to take our next call, Mr. Lettergar.
Yes, sir.
Prior to President Johnson, do you recall any incidents or can you relate any incidents where the country was involved in foreign action that was unauthorized by a president?
Well, it was unauthorized by a president?
Right.
I'm not too sure I understand your question, Mr. Shields. I'm not being obscure, but do you mean that was unauthorized by a Congress?
No, by a president. Were there any incidents that you can recall where a president called to the fore our troops and placed them overseas or placed them in other countries without getting sanctioning from Congress? Or without seeking approval.
The only time a president has ever been brought to task for such a colossal blunder as that has ever been brought to task, and certainly one who committed a colossal blunder like that would be, was President Johnson, who followed President Lincoln, and he was acquitted in the impeachment proceedings.
Well,
I mean, he has wide authority, you understand, as Commander in Chief of the Armed Forces, and as having constitutional responsibility for the foreign affairs of this country.
Was there a memorandum issued in 1966 that stated that there were at least 125 instances in which the president ordered the armed forces without seeking prior congressional approval?
Memorandum issued by whom?
I don't know who authored it. It's a State Department memorandum. You're not familiar with it.
Instances were quoted where armed forces were committed abroad.
Where the president ordered the armed forces to take action or maintain positions abroad without obtaining prior congressional authorization.
Well, sir, I'm sure you and I could sit here just together and tick off at least 30 or 40 at the top of our heads.
Well, were these actions authorized?
I mean, they're not unauthorized because there's no requirement that the president seek congressional approval for this. He has full power under the Constitution. However, and the point I tried to make before is that as a leader, and after all, that one should try to interpret your actions, decisions, and actions based on those decisions to the general public. If you're a leader of the people, leader of your own party, one way to do that is to explain them and get from the representatives of the people an expression of agreement.
But
it's not legally necessary. It's sometimes felt by presidents to be a good idea.
Well, does the president have a constitutional right to involve our troops? This is the question that I'm trying to get to, really.
To involve our troops?
Our troops in any kind of foreign action, right?
Well, absolutely he does. You know how many treaties that we have that the treaties, of course, are with the advice and consent of the Senate. Once the treaty is in force, the President is instructed by the Senate, by the Constitution, to take into, set into train a certain series of actions. It would be impossible to, in this day and age, when it takes 17 minutes for a intercontinental ballistic missile to get from some of the geographical areas presently occupied by those who claim to be our enemies, right here to Washington, D.C., or there to New York City, 17 minutes, to have it otherwise than the commander-in-chief being fully empowered.
Well, if the Constitution has stated that The Congress of the United States must be given the power, or is given the power to wage war or to send troops abroad. Are we at a point in our history now where the responsibility actually is being taken by the president or is being given to the president?
Well, we can get into some very interesting interpretations of constitutional law and trends in recent years. I don't think that myself. I don't think there are very many critics of our present foreign policy in Southeast Asia who make other than potshot brownie points on the business of lack of authority or the will of Congress having once been expressed has been changed, except they don't seem to want to put it to a test again and so forth. There's no question as to the legality of the action. The question really arises, though, as to what may be in the future Congress's attitude toward the ratification of mutual security agreements, for example. This may be very seriously affected by what has happened in Vietnam over the past several years and what may happen before we bring this thing to a successful conclusion. And that's something that worries me. And I'm sure it worries all the senators and all the representatives, too. There really is, I think, in my opinion, there really needs to be some dialogue between the executive and the legislature on this point so that there is less opportunity for something as divisive of the country as has taken place recently to occur in the future.
We'll accept another call, Mr. Lettergar. Our next call from Newark, New Jersey. Mr. King is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM. Welcome to Night Call, sir.
Thank you. I'd like to talk about the cost on the Vietnam War monthly, just about how much is it costing America fighting and house and clothing in Vietnam?
Well, it's very difficult to calculate, sir, because And one will tend to use those set of figures that will, most lead in the direction of the argument that that you might want to draw from the basis of the cost. You have to answer the following. We have an army of such and such a size in being. If they are in Vietnam, are their entire salaries, their entire equipment and their attire and so forth, is that added to the cost of the war? Obviously, the expendables, things that they expend, would be direct cost of the war. You have to also answer the following question. In terms of economic aid there, the fact that 92 cents on every dollar of economic aid that goes to Vietnam is spent in this country, it amounts to business for U.S. businessmen, jobs for U.S. workers. Should you charge the whole 100 cents on the dollar to the cost of the Vietnam War, or do you charge only the 8 cents, which actually goes out of this country in terms of gold flow? No doubt about it, the costs are massive. I don't know what Congress and the people would decide if we did not have, or if we suddenly, please God, could get rid of this problem we have there. I don't know what they would decide should be done with that amount of money here in this country. Maybe, hopefully, more of it would go into domestic problems than we have been able to put in the past. I don't know. There's not too much in the past history of this country that encourages me along the way.
Thank you. If there is no agreement, no plan or anything to come together, how long are we prepared to go on fighting this war?
I'm hesitating.
When the cost of the of living over here increases with every income tax increase, and we're paying tax on from bubblegum to drawers. Just how long are we going to fight the war, when no agreement can be made?
Well, no one will disagree that if it becomes so expensive that it's beyond our capability internationally, mm-hmm. or if our domestic problems become so exacerbated we must decide that this is a higher priority, that the Vietnam War would and our commitment there may have to be modified. Mr. King might disagree as to when that point would be reached.
Mr. King and Mr. Lettergar, we thank you. We must break for station identification and then we'll be coming back. Thank you so much for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night now.
Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Stephen Ledigar after station identification. Listen to the voices of Night Call.
We're trying to bring about change in this nation through nonviolent channels. Now, if we cannot do it through nonviolence, there are other forces that are going to lead people down a violent path, and the nation will be destroyed.
Ralph Abernathy on apathy and violence. And a white industrialist says jobs will save us from a racial inferno.
It's better to learn and earn than to burn, baby, burn. Now, these are the changes in attitude that spring from the community as a whole to try to work with these people, not just work on them, and to have industry reach into the area and try to recruit and hire the guy that's qualified and to get the other fellow to take training so he, too, can get a job.
Speak for yourself on Night Call. Speak for yourself, collect on Night Call, area code 212-749-3311 or 866-5010 to Stephen Ledigar about what are we doing in Vietnam. Again, Del Shields.
And we'll continue accepting calls from our nightclub. I'll say nightclub tonight. I don't know what I have my mind on. But our Night Call listeners. And we'll be listening or hearing from Mrs. Graves of Seattle, Washington, who's listening to Night Call over KUOW-FM. Welcome to Night Call.
Oh, hello.
Welcome to Night Call, Mrs. Graves.
Thank you. My question pertains to land reform. You said, I believe, that you felt that the majority of the people of South Vietnam were in favor of our being there and not in favor of the Viet Cong. Now, I understand that we're... The Viet Cong has taken over. They have promised the land. In fact, they have returned the land to the farmers that till it. Then when we go in and take over that territory, we bring back the landlord system with their terribly oppressive rent and back rents and so forth. Now, Tran Van Dien, a former official of the South Vietnamese government who is here, Professor Roy Prosterman of the University of Washington, have both stressed very much the need of land reform there if we are to win the hearts of the people of South Vietnam and have any success in this war at all. Professor Prosterman has mentioned that he has figured it out from a number of studies he's made there that we could put in a good land reform there for what it costs us now for about 1 week of the war there. Now, would you like to comment on that, please?
Well, I read Professor Prosterman's work on it, and I think it's a very excellent paper. Not one paper, he's written quite a bit, as you know, and made several trips out there. There's no doubt about the fact that land reform has been a very substantial issue in this conflict, and it's very easy for revolutionaries, insurgents, to come in and say, in a situation that does not have good land tenure legislation, to say that if you come and follow our, quote, revolution, unquote, the land that you till will be yours. It's also true that in the early days of the conflict with the vestiges of French colonialism, there was very unequal land distribution. It's also true that in 1956, under the Diem administration, that there were very significant and substantial land tenure reforms that were placed on the books, as Professor Prosterman has pointed out. And quite a bit has been done in just enforcing those. The problem right now is recognized by experts, including the professor, is not one of need so much for new legislation. It's a need for security so that the present legislation can be effected, implemented. There's a massive amount of land that's still held by the government that is ready for distribution just as soon as it can get back into some areas that are insecure. Well, I'm sorry, you have something to say?
Mrs. Graves?
Yes, well, I have heard Professor Prosterman a number of times, and I get an entirely different interpretation than what you do. I understand that this so-called land reform supposed to have been put forth through Diem was practically nothing. It didn't actually take effect, that there has been, and I even various correspondence that I have clippings from a number of people who have said that there just hasn't been land reform put through there.
Well, I'm afraid that he's, parts of some of his works are quoted by those who insist that land reform is the only issue in Vietnam. He covers the whole waterfront on land reform, and is one of the first experts to recognize exactly what the true nature of the problem is. Now, as you mentioned earlier, in the at one time, before the distribution provided for in the 56 regulations took place, there was the anomaly of when the area was controlled by the communist insurgents, there were no rents that were collected. When the government troops came in, they were followed by the landlords who said, okay, now is time to pay those back rents. And this has caused a great deal of problem. This has since been corrected by legislation whereby during any period of insecurity in the countryside, the rent for that time is just suspended and is not due and payable at any future time. The government can't provide protection. You don't have to pay your land rent.
Mrs. Graves, thank you for calling. Thank you. This is Night Call in New York. Our next caller, Mr. Bullock, is listening to Night Call over KOGO-FM in San Diego, California. Welcome to Night Call, sir.
Good evening. Mr. Lettergaard, I have a question regarding the credibility gap. By that I mean that if we were to look at the public news media, such as newspapers or news magazines or what we hear on the radio and television on a day-to-day basis, we get an impression of one type of action going on. Yet when we gather information from the official releases of the State Department or other representative bodies or people who are representatives of the official position of our government, we get a different position. And as you might characterize me personally as, say, a blade in the grassroots movement of the country, I'm at the bottom of the heap trying to find out what's going on. I'd like to know what your suggestion is as to how to resolve the two different positions, because even from the callers tonight, I can very definitely see that there is a discrepancy between what you and the State Department believe to be what's going on and what the callers and the people across the country, if the callers are representative of them, believe to be going on. Now, I would prefer to believe and hope that our State Department and our officials are aware of the actual problems and are actually representing us in as true a fashion as possible. And yet with the widespread disbelief in the official bodies of government and their position, this is pretty hard for me to continue to do. And it's very disillusioning, very disheartening, and of course, I believe there are many, many hundreds and thousands of people that are in the same position as myself and would therefore be very upset about it that their representatives are not doing what they thought they were doing and therefore very disillusioned and very irate. So I guess that would conclude my comment. I would be interested in hearing what you'd have to say on this.
Well, I think it's a very excellent comment, and you touch on a tremendous problem. One that is recognized by the most responsible members of the Fourth Estate. One that is recognized by us, and I think we are the first ones to admit that the fact that there is a problem of this sort existing is as much our fault as it is theirs. We took a tact as full advisors back in the days of the Diem regime, where we felt that as guests, as advisors, it was not our position to correct the misinformation being handed out by the South Vietnamese government. And it happened back then in the early days of resident journalists in Saigon that those who did not listen to the press handouts of the Diem regime, and who went out to the Buddhist pagodas and got out to the country to side themselves, turned out to with a better story than that which was being put out by the Vietnamese government with our silence behind it. All the Pulitzer Prizes went to those who rejected the government's position and went out and did groundwork on their own. Mm-hmm. That, I think, is the origin of the problem. The problem has been exacerbated by what I think were unfortunate decisions on both sides.
Thank you for calling, sir.
All right, thank
Hello?
You.
Are we just out of time?
No, I want to take just one more call, sir. Thank you. We have time for one more call, and we'll take it from Miami, Florida. Mr. Paul Gettleman is listening to Night Call over WAME. Welcome to Night Call, sir.
Hello. Mr. Lettergaard?
Yes, hello.
I would like to direct my question to the use of herbicides and defoliage by the United States and Vietnam. Now, it seems, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but before around 1954, South Vietnam was, although it was an underdeveloped nation, I don't think the people were starving. And I think that the South Vietnamese not only grew enough rice to feed themselves, but they also had millions of tons of rice to export to other Asian countries. Now, it seems that since 1964, the South Vietnamese have become rather dependent on the U.S. I think we export 600,000 tons of rice per year to South Vietnam. Now, that would seem to just be opposite of what we wanted to accomplish here with our underdeveloped country aid. I would also like to know, what do you feel the long-term effects of spraying these herbicides are to strip leaves from trees and shrubs? I mean, do you think this might have an extent to a serious and lasting damage to the soil and agriculture, or even what extent it might have to damaging the people?
Well, first of all, it's very much like the allegation that there are 1 million South Vietnamese babies that have been killed by napalm or something like this. You get the picture from some commentators that the whole country is there with limp leaves and no green foliage. I defy anyone to take an airplane, fly anywhere in Vietnam and find where defoliation has taken place. Either you have to go very, very close to specific remote areas where VC and North Vietnamese troops have made base camp areas where we have defoliated tree canopy jungles, non-productive areas, with the permission of the Vietnamese government in all cases, in order to expose their secret rendezvous points and caches. I think it's very important, there's other points that you bring up, to realize that there have been, unfortunately, tragically, almost 2 million people who have been uprooted from the farm. Now, they have all walked into the area.
Mr. Lettergaard? Mr. Lettergaard, Mr. Gettleman, thank you so much for calling.
Very well, thank you.
Mr. Lettergaard, thank you so much for being our guest here in New York tonight. This is Del Shields. Good night and peace.
Good night, sir.
Mr. Lettergaard?
Night Call, the new nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tomorrow night, same time, same station. What are we doing in Vietnam, part two? Are we our own worst enemy in that war? William Lederer says so. Ask him yourself. Listen tomorrow night. Discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, and National Urban Coalition.